leaders.
We pose the problems of human beings in their relations with the world.
Change.
GP made this one right here. You know it's a hit.
Impact.
Liberation is a praxis of action, team reflection upon the world.
Welcome to the pedagogy of the obsessed.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am proud to be on joined by the legendary Nancy Gutierrez from the New York City Leadership Academy. Nancy, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to be here, James.
I got to tell all the listeners out there, I have a personal interest in this particular podcast. Nancy is one of my favorite human beings when it comes to education leadership. We have run in the same circles for the last few years, whether we knew it or not, but most recently, as I am completing my third year in the Doctor of Education Leadership program, Nancy is one of the original graduates of our program. She is from the first cohort of the EDLD program, and I'm super proud to have watched her journey and to just be in her presence. You know, whenever we talk about education leadership, she's so inspirational and amazing, and she just makes you feel like after you listen to something she has to say that you can go out and conquer the world on behalf of children. So thank you for all that you do and the inspiration that you provide to many of us in the world of leadership.
I appreciate it. I have a huge smile on my face. Thank you so much. What an honor for you to say that. I'm very humbled.
All right, Nancy, let's get straight into it. So as the CEO of New York City Leadership Academy, would you start by just sharing with us your work and your education work journey?
First, you have to know that I'm from a beautiful, large Mexican family and community from East San Jose, California, which is actually where I spent the majority of my career. And I've worked at every level of the system within my home community, from teacher to school principal of two different middle schools to district leader. So I think what really brings me into this space is the narrative that students of color who live in poverty need to escape in order to be successful, right? This leave to succeed mindset is what my colleague Roberto Badia and I call it. And I've always had to defy it, and I've always not only felt and understood what low expectations feel like, but I always sought to do something different or to react in a way that was more productive than perhaps I had reacted as a younger person. And so that's really kind of what brings me to the community is that personal work about really understanding the richness and the beauty that lives and exists in communities that are often underestimated and underserved.
We are now, if I'm correct, celebrating 1 year of you becoming the CEO of the New York City Leadership Academy. Tell me a little bit about, you know, your time there.
Well, I'm quite surprised that I'm actually in this seat right now and in this role, because my dream was to actually return to my home community of East San Jose and become the superintendent, to continue to always pour into the community I love most in this world, into my home. Actually, when I was getting my doctorate, was very much for me a form of protest of what people typically expect of students like me from communities that are predominantly communities of color, predominantly low income. And one of the reasons why I chose a residency with the New York City Department of Education was because being from a small community, I wanted to see what it was like. To be in the largest district in this country. I also was interested in studying mayoral control, you know, and really understanding the position and role of boards within education. But as I was in the district, I was studying the knowledge and skills gap that exists between a really exceptional school principal and a district leader. Mm. Now, there's a gap there, and I think we see it across the country. I don't think it's a secret to anyone that there is a gap within those two spaces. And I remember when I was a school principal, the district asking me, Nancy, what can we do? You know, how can we be of best support? And I would say, the best thing you could do is to leave me alone. You know, that hey, let me do my job. You know, let us do what we're doing really well. My community understands our needs, and we're on it.
Right.
Obviously, that wasn't the right response. But I think the message there is that that there often tends to be a little bit of friction between the two entities. And when I moved and shifted to the district level, I thought, wow, like, I can't imagine what would be possible if these two entities actually work together in a cohesive way, in unison, really pushing toward the same goal with the hub, with the school as the hub and as the nucleus of the community. You know, and sort of reversing that hierarchy that in some, for whatever reason, districts are above and the schools are below.
Right.
The schools actually should be front and center and at the top of all support that surrounds it. While I was there, I created a program for exceptional leaders to obtain superintendent certification through the state of New York and to, you know, get exposed to positions such as, you know, network leaders, superintendent, a variety of different central office roles, and really, I think, challenging the assumption that what makes you good in one role makes you good in the next, right? Because that's where some of that division was coming from, right? To say, hey, great job as a teacher. All right, you are now the principal. Great job as a principal. Let's move you up to the district level. And now you oversee all state and federal programs across the entire district. It just doesn't work that way. We don't pay enough attention to transition, right? And so my work was really around how do we create space to actually grow people who, yes, are exceptional, but into a new role that will require a different skill set. And in doing that, I had the opportunity to meet Irma Zardoya and the team at the New York City Leadership Academy, who were building my capacity to do that really effectively. And yeah, that was my first introduction. And it would be a few years later that I would end up joining the team.
I almost feel like that's one of those unspoken things. And you just hit the nail on the head right there. We make these assumptions that just because you're good in one role means that you'll be naturally good in another role. But without that support and that explicit training, that's not true. So talk to me then about how that, you know, plays out in your role now with the New York City Leadership Academy and the work that you're doing across the country. I believe you're in 36 states, is it?
That's correct. Nice memory there, Jim.
Yeah, how about that?
It gave me the opportunity to really think about that role and, you know, development of exceptional adults from a systems thinking lens and also a national lens. And so taking this work and then starting off here, literally doing design and facilitation of learning over time has transitioned to, you know, to leading this great organization. What drew me to this organization? A few things. One is that there is a very deep belief that context matters, right? That equity will look different in every single setting across this country and that you need to know that, understand it, and never think you have the silver bullet. If you ever think you have a solution from the community and you're not from the community, you got to check yourself.
Yep.
Because you're not only going to wreck yourself, but you're going to wreck everyone with whom you are engaged.
Mm-hmm.
That was one. Two, there was a commitment to equity from the beginning of this organization. Back 16 years ago, it was about butts in seats. Like, how do we diversify our leadership pipeline across New York City with specific focus on getting more women in those seats? And getting more leaders of color in those seats. 66% of our graduates are leaders of color, and the same percentage are women. And so, you know, both we were successful in both diversifying the pipeline and making sure it was representative of the population. So that was another reason why I was so interested in, like, wow, like 16 years ago, folks weren't talking about this. We weren't talking about the fact that our leaders and our teachers did not represent the populations we were serving. And the Leadership Academy was doing that. And not only that, but there was also a real depth of knowledge around adult learning and what it actually means. And it never, ever means that you sit in a room and just learn from someone lecturing at you.
Right.
Never means that.
Mm-hmm.
Never. It's about, you know, it's about experiential learning. It's about hands-on. It's about being job embedded. It's about, you know, really understanding how to apply some of these concepts into practice. And there's this real key knowledge on adult learning, a focus on, you know, equity, a real understanding of context and, you know, the way in which all of this work plays out in different ways in different settings. And so that really drew me to wanting to be part of this organization and to really learn what this looked like in different districts across the country.
That you are unapologetic about is your commitment to leading for equity. Now, that's at the forefront of everything that you say and do, all of the messaging that comes out of the New York City Leadership Academy. From your perspective, what is your vision for advancing the cause of leading for equity?
I think across the country, we are all defining it in different ways, which it should be the case because it's going to be different. But there are some commonalities that we believe are consistent across, not only across context, but across levels. What would be great is actually if I shared with you five different leadership dispositions that we believe cut across level and cut across position.
Perfect.
The first one, the first one we really talk about, integrate, and this, by the way, does not replace the standards by which leaders need to be held to do their job most effectively, but they should be dispositions or ways of being, right, that we enact as part of our day-to-day work.
Okay.
And so the first one we really talk about is you know, it's the self work, it's the inner work, right? And that is when you are reflecting on your personal assumptions, your beliefs, your behaviors, and all of that stuff is internal. And often a place where people get stuck, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very, very hard place to be in and a hard place to hold up a mirror and understand kind of where you are in this journey, right? It has nothing to do with a policy, nothing to do with a leadership move, but all about you personally and how your experiences and your upbringing have colored your perspective on this work. So that's the first, the inner work. The second is really around modeling a personal belief system that is student-centered and grounded in equity. And there's a difference between the first disposition is let me do my inner work, and the second is let me make some of those beliefs public. There's a very, very, very political thing that happens when you shift into making those beliefs and that vision really clear and transparent and public to the stakeholders to whom you are accountable. But we believe that's a necessary step in order to really enact these values. The third is around how you're acting with ultra competence and responsiveness in your interactions, your day-to-day decision-making. You know, call us when you want to understand what that work looks like in practice.
Yes.
When you're interested and able to and willing to actually have coaching, you know, within your actual context and understand how to transfer the theory that we just engaged in into practice. Mm-hmm. One does not work without the other.
Yeah.
Right. And so the third decision is really around like, how does it, you know, impact your day to day? The fourth one is really around how are you confronting, you know, some of those institutional biases that are actually greater than yourself, that are actually, you may not have directly caused or created as a result of your position as the leader there, but you have to own them, because if you don't, who will?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to take responsibility for actually confronting things that have existed for years upon years upon years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's like deficit-based schooling, low expectations associated with race, but a variety of factors that you frankly just, you have to own and be willing to take on. And
yeah.
As you can see, these keep getting more and more deep as
oh,
you
yeah.
go.
Oh, yeah.
And the last one, but certainly not the least, is really around the shift of systems and structures. Right. It's really around thinking of, you know, how are you actually doing things that will outlive your tenure? If you're not thinking about equity as a way to outlive your tenure, then you're thinking about yourself.
Mm.
You're thinking about your reputation. You're thinking about how to, you know, make sure people know, you know, what you're about, you know, and it's like, don't just talk about it. You got to be about it, and not just be about it, but you got to put things in place that do not rely on you to continue them over time. Right. So the last one is really about it. So that's how we define it. We define it as a set of dispositions and ways of being that really transcend any role within leadership.
Yeah, absolutely. You just said a whole sermon right then and there. What are some things that leaders can do right now?
I think the first thing we have to really name here is that leadership is never about authority.
Mm.
Never about title.
Can you say that again?
Never about role. I'll say it for the people in the back.
Yes, please.
Leadership is never about authority, about title, about role. I don't know who fooled us into thinking that was the case, but in this work, we actually work with people. We serve people. We are in a role of service to communities, to schools, to systems. And it's also never done by one person.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's done at all levels, and we all play different roles as part of that work. And so that's the first thing you have to understand. If you are caught up in some idea that you're some sort of superhero, you've already lost the game.
Yep.
Right? And when you don't understand that the difference between power and authority and influence and the authorized environment in which you are working, then again, you've lost the game. And so being really clearly aware of who the authorizers are in the environment may not be the same people with authority.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that makes sense, but the authorizers of the work and of movements and of change may not be people with titles.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one thing, is just to really, really get clear on that. Let's not be fooled by titles here. I think the second thing is that you have to understand what it means for your context. And the only way you can really do that is through data. And I know that you talked to Kathy Baudet, DataWise, and you know, which is a process I am very, very fond of. And if you, it's not about anyone's opinion or what people think. What it is about, multiple forms of data to really understand the state of affairs and the context in which you are working.
Let me give you a scenario here. Let's say that I'm in rural America, and I get it. as the leader of that particular, let's say, school. But the folks around me are resistant to the change. As we know, you know, all change is really hard to handle. You know, what would you suggest I do?
It is not surprising that I would say if you could pull on one lever in the system, it would be that of leadership, that you would make sure there is an exceptional school leader at the helm of every single school.
If you would you be willing to share just some of those highlights that come to mind that should be at the top of every education leader's mind as they do the good work of educating our children?
So I'll highlight the leadership lessons. So let's start with the first. The first was really around something we've been talking about a lot today, which is that context matters, right? Andres Alonso, former chief of Baltimore Public Schools, talks about respecting the mountain, right? Mm-hmm. And really understanding the importance of identity and history, and that you can't lead real change without understanding the community in which you are entering. And another lesson that I repeat in my head over and over and over again, and over and over and over again, because it's so important, is around subverting ego to task. Mm-hmm. Now, ego gets in the way every time if we are not careful. Mm-hmm. And if we had any insight into our ego and the pain it has caused ourselves and our loved ones, we would be absolutely astonished. My Harvard advisor, Bob Keegan, he would always say, you have such a great resume, so many great accomplishments, and that'll last you about 15 minutes.
Ooh.
And, you know, and he would always talk about what mattered most was, you know, how we treated each other, you know, and how we engaged in the work, and mm-hmm. and whether or not we saw people's humanity.
Mm-hmm.
What's one leadership lesson you think about all the time? Like, what is something that stays front and center? And he says, I've learned that it's rarely about me, but sometimes it is, you know, and I think, and I think acknowledging that there's a lot of self in this work, and you mm-hmm. can't divorce, you know, who you are and, you know, your own aspirations and experiences from this work is critical, that that we learn to play with our whole deck of cards, you know, as we engage in this work. Another big lesson that I've thought about a lot is around how you have to continue to leverage stories to mobilize communities to action, right?
Okay.
Stories are, we use stories to call upon shared values. There is power in telling those stories. My friend, Katiuska Moreno, always talks about, she's with Teach for America, and she always tells me, hey, if you don't tell your story, guess what? Someone else will.
That's right.
Right. And so to really to take ownership of that, you know, and it's not just, and look, I'm not talking about standing in front of people because you're the leader and taking advantage of the fact that you have the floor and talking to people for 20 minutes about yourself.
Right.
No one cares to
right.
listen to your life story for I'm talking about 3 to 5 minutes of a very succinct why of what makes you wake up every morning to do the work that you do, what brings you into this room. Mm-hmm. Connecting with shared values as a result of those stories,
mm-hmm.
You know, and using it, you know, you can use a PowerPoint with a list of what you care about, or you can actually share it from the heart, you know,
right.
And Marshall Gans talks about, you know, heart, head, and hands, and those three having to work together in order to really push the work forward. And so this idea of storytelling is critical.
How have you been able to do just that? I mean, I know I have been a witness to that, you know, on several occasions over the last few years. But, you know, for those that haven't quite gotten a chance to meet you yet or be in a room where you're presenting, you know, what are ways that you approach storytelling and letting the people get to know who the real Nancy is?
Well, I'll tell you about when I didn't engage, which
okay.
was my first 5 years as school principal. So I ended up becoming the principal of a middle school that was only 2 blocks down the street from where my mom still lives today.
Oh, wow.
All right.
Okay.
So, yeah. You know, it was, you know, it was so personal. It was really deep personal work.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being a school principal and I was almost robotic, to tell you the truth. Like, I was just like so focused and I'm like, we got to do the damn thing. Like, let's do it. Like,
mm-hmm.
there's so much work that has to be done. And literally, my mother attended this school. Literally, my little brother attended this school. I mean, there was so much work that I had to do. And, you know, I came down really, really hard and really tried to think about everything I had to do. I'd stay up late, make lists, you know, try to like move forward on my agenda.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until year 6 that I actually shared my story with the community.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I had grown up only 2 blocks down and I didn't think it was about me was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
It was literally, it's always about you, you know, like people want to be part of a bigger vision. They want to work collectively towards a bigger vision. And they also want inspiration. So guess what? Right. You know, if you are at the helm of that organization, like, tell them why you're inspired. Mm-hmm. Tell them what brings you into that space. You know, and the moment that I shared that with my staff, even though we had already become, you know, we were working on being a family across the school, we became tighter than we had ever been. Mm-hmm. Because I was willing to be vulnerable and open myself up in ways that were really, you know, really sensitive for me and share, you know, and use storytelling as a lever to do that. I didn't realize it was important until way late in my principal career. So yeah, I know it's important.
All right. So tell me a little more about the lessons learned in your first year at the New York City Leadership Academy.
There's another lesson that I'm going to call you. You have to choose whether or not you want to be Spock or Captain Kirk, right? And my residency advisor in New York City, he would always say, look, you know, this is a shout out to Anthony Canelli. And Anthony still always say, look, you know, you got to choose. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, do you want to be Spock or do you want to be Captain Kirk? He's like, look, I've chosen to be Spock majority of my career because I keep my head down. I get it done. You know, I do what I love. Mm-hmm. And guess what? My family at home, they're also much happier with me when I love what I'm doing on a daily basis. And it really stood out to me because I think there's a lot about, you know, there's a lot of ambition and I respect and I admire and I love ambition. And I think that there are different places for us at different times of our lives. Yeah. Depending on our life circumstance, depending on what we're best suited to do, mm-hmm. you know, and it requires a lot of checking of our ego and understanding who we are and where we'll have the most impact, you know, in order to really, I think, but having that humility mm-hmm. is really what makes the difference, you know, and understanding where you're going to add the most value to the lives of our children. And then the last one is just around staying in the game, mm-hmm. you know, that equity work is long-term work.
Yeah.
Right. And to do it, we have to be, you know, to understand our, you know, what we're willing to stomach along the way. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. And any leadership role at any level comes with a lot of complexity. Understanding that we all work in with a variety of authorized environments, you know, and so Mark Moore from the Harvard Kennedy School would always talk about, you know, understanding how to navigate the political spaces in which we work. Mm-hmm. And look, if we're in public education and we believe in equity and we understand and know that it requires really bold thinking and bold leadership moves, you have to actually navigate that within an authorizing space.
Yeah.
And so, you know, understanding what that is for your context is going to be really important to have you stay in the game and be part of the work for the long term. Mm-hmm. And again, we all play different roles on the court, right? If we're going to do a sports analogy here, we all play different roles and we're all needed. And so at some points you might be in a different position and role than you are in other points. Mm-hmm. But the trick is to all move in unison together towards the same vision. But we need you in the game because without you in the game, you're not doing anyone any good.
You have any pro tips for staying in the game?
Yeah, I recently read Jean Monnet, you know, one of the founding fathers of the European Union. And one thing that struck me was that he talked a lot about the need for space, time, and for nature to stay in the game. He said, to see it clearly, I have to concentrate, which I can only do in isolation on long solitary walks. And he talked about dealing with some very, very complex problems. And he says, when I'm stuck in routine, I head to the mountain. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's important because I think it's easy for us. And I'm a workaholic. I'm very guilty of sometimes just diving in and staying there and sometimes doing that is not the best for your thinking. It's not when you're at your very best,
yeah.
Right? It's when you're actually, you know, balanced and all these other aspects of your life that you can actually give your work the best of you. And, you know, the other thing I'll say is when you are in these positions, you have the opportunity to either make that balance more difficult for your staff mm-hmm. or to nurture it. Mm-hmm. And you know, so there are things, for example, when I first stepped into the role that we wanted to do right away. So one of the things we said was, look, you know, in December during holiday season, we're going to shut down at the end of the month for a week. Uh-huh. And we had never shut down before at the same time because we were all working on different projects. And let me tell you who that was really impacting. It was impacting our operations team, right? Because they had to make sure everything was flowing. And so they, you know, so shutting down the entire office did something pretty incredible for our staff last year. Mm-hmm. And we let each other enjoy our lives outside of work. And we hadn't done that in the past. The other thing that, another move we made right away last October was to say, you know, any 3-day weekends, you know, we're going to leave the office at 1 PM You know, and if you're trying to head somewhere out with your family, like you can beat traffic, or if you're, you can plan for it. And, you know, I say this because there are little things that any leader can do to make that balance much easier for everyone who works within that organization. Or we can make it very, very difficult and send emails, you know, at midnight and expect a response. You know, there are, so we have to take care of ourselves, but also take care of our team.
That's right.
And if we're not taking care of our team, then how will our team do their best thinking? Okay. And again, nothing perfect, but we're working on it, you know, always practicing, always working.
That's right. We certainly want to thank you, Nancy, for spending time with us today on the Pedagogy of the Obsessed.
We pose the problems of human beings in their relations with the world. Knowledge emerges only through invention and reinvention, through the restless and patient continuing, hopeful inquiry human beings pursue in the world, with the world, and with each other. The solution is not to integrate them into the structure of oppression, but to transform that structure so that they become beings for themselves. Liberation is a praxis of action and reflection on the world.